welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, delivering programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Levonier, and coming up in this hour, True History. Later on, the story of a naval commander on the Cavalcade of America, but right now it's the You Are There series, with a program dedicated to June 30th, 1520, called Montezuma and the Spaniards. This first heard on CBS on May 1st, 1949.
This is Don Hollenbeck on top of the pyramidal temple of the Aztec war god in Mexico City. On this 30th of June, 1520, a short distance away from us, the Aztec priests are beating their giant assembly drum. It is summoning the Emperor Montezuma and Prince Cuitlahua to their meeting in the square below us, in front of the royal palace. General Hernando Cortes and his Spanish expedition are trapped in that palace where they hold Montezuma as hostage. The meeting between the Aztec Emperor and Prince Cuitlahua, who commands the besieging forces, will determine whether Montezuma will order his warriors to lift the siege and let the Spaniards leave the city unharmed, or to attack and destroy the Spanish invaders, even if it costs Montezuma his life. The slow, ponderous rhythm of the huge Aztec drum is rolling and echoing through the square. 10 giant priests are beating it in unison. The drum is...
June 30th, 1520... Mexico City, you are there.
The Aztec people wait to learn whether their emperor, the fabulous Montezuma, a prisoner of General Cortez, will betray them to save his own life. CBS takes you back 429 years to a drama of treason and death in the conquest of Mexico. All things are as they were then, except for one thing. When CBS is there,
you are there.
You Are There, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne, is based on authentic historical fact and quotation. And now...
Mexico City, the temple of the Aztec god of war, and Don Hollenbeck.
The fate of the Cortez expedition and the destiny of Montezuma, traitor or national martyr. The Emperor Montezuma has been a hostage of the Spanish this past month, ever since General Cortez invaded the Aztec sanctuaries and destroyed the images of their gods. At that time, the Emperor ordered the Spaniards to leave Mexico. Instead, General Cortez seized Montezuma. The Aztecs then laid siege to the royal palace. They didn't attack. Out of fear for their Emperor's life, they hoped to starve the Spaniards into submission. Then yesterday, General Cortez arranged a truce with Prince Cuitlahua. The prince is Montezuma's younger brother, commander of the besiegers. General Cortez said the emperor wished to speak to the prince as the commander of the royal armies. There's been no official indication of what the emperor plans to say, but unofficially, Spanish officers have told us that Montezuma has promised General Cortez he will order the siege lifted. That meeting will take place on a pavilion set up in the square below us, directly in front of the entrance to the palace. 100,000 Aztec warriors are drawn up down there in the square. Beyond them, the avenues leading to the square are packed with Aztec civilians waiting for a glimpse of their emperor. The rooftops around the square are also crowded with watchers. In the distance, we see the blue lakes which ring the city beyond the towering snow-tipped mountains of Mexico. The priests have now stopped beating the assembly drum. John Daly at the pavilion reports that Prince Cuitlahua has arrived there, so down to John Daly.
Prince Cuitlahua is standing a few feet away from us in conversation with his officers. He's a tall man, athletic and bronzed, wears armor of hammered gold, over it a surcoat of brilliantly colored feathers. His helmet is of polished silver, and his officers are also brilliantly attired. The Aztecs, of course, love colorful dress. Less colorful are the heads of several murdered Spaniards displayed on the tips of the spears of a line of Aztec warriors who accompany Cuitlahua's party. The Spaniards were captured by the Aztecs during the siege and were sacrificed to the Aztec god of war. Unless Montezuma means to secure a safe exit for Cortez and his men, the remaining Spaniards may very well meet a similar fate. Prince Cuitlahua has ended his conversation. He's coming this way. Your Highness, have you any idea why the Emperor Montezuma has summoned you to this meeting?
Attack. The Emperor will command us to attack the palace and destroy the invaders.
But, Your Highness, the Spanish officers say that Montezuma has promised General Cortez that he will command you to lift the siege and let the Spaniards go.
Promised? The emperor would promise anything to get the opportunity to speak to his people. Montezuma has tricked General Cortez. His Majesty knows that we have been withholding the attack out of fear for the emperor's person.
Well, on that point, Prince Cuitlahua, the Spaniards suggest that General Cortez has threatened to kill Montezuma unless he makes good his promise.
That may be, but Aztecs do not fear death. My brother will die gladly, if need be, to defend the sovereignty of the Aztec nation.
I see. Well, then, you think the sovereignty of your nation is involved in the situation today?
The Spaniards are invaders. As long as they are alive, Mexico is not safe.
But, Your Highness, isn't it possible that Montezuma will ask you to let the Spaniards go? Doesn't he believe that they're immortal beings? Didn't your ancient prophets predict that white men would come to Mexico to overthrow the rule of the Aztecs?
Yes, our priests did make that prophecy. We Aztecs still believe that someday the true white gods will appear. The Spaniards are invaders, imposters. For a while we accepted them. We had never seen white men before, or horses, or guns, or cannon. We treated them as honored guests. And how did they repay our hospitality? They desecrated our temples, smashed our idols. And we knew they were men, men with false hearts. And to prove they are mortal, we have cut off the heads of many of them. And the other Spaniards behind the palace walls will die the same way.
Thank you, Prince Cuitlahua. The prince has rejoined his officers. There's still no sign of the Emperor Montezuma. He hasn't as yet left the royal palace, but General Cortez has appeared on the wall of the palace, and Doug Edwards is with him. So go ahead, Doug Edwards.
General Cortez still wears a blood-stained bandage over the wound he received in his right arm yesterday, a wound inflicted by an Aztec arrow. General Cortez, do you know what the Emperor Montezuma will say to Prince Cuitlahua?
Of course. The Emperor will say what I have told him to say. He will order that rabble of half-naked savages to lift the siege.
Did the Emperor promise to give that order?
He did.
Well, did he give you that promise willingly?
He did not.
Well, how do you know the Emperor won't trick you, General? Prince Cuitlahua suggested that a moment ago. Isn't it possible that when Montezuma actually meets Prince Cuitlahua, he will order the Aztecs to attack you?
When Montezuma speaks to that barbarian brother of his, 50 Spanish muskets will be aimed at his back. If the Emperor has really snared us, his dead body shall bait the trap.
But, General, Prince Cuitlahua argues that the Aztecs do not fear death. He thinks the Emperor would die gladly to rid Mexico of Spaniards.
Some of these pagans may not fear death, but I assure you that isn't true of their emperor. You may recall that twice before the Aztecs rose up against us. Each time I prodded Montezuma gently with my sword, and he calmed his pagan hordes. He will do it again today.
But if you are mistaken, General, if Montezuma does trick you, what do you expect will happen?
We'll kill Montezuma and as many Aztecs as we can and fight our way out of Mexico.
One last question, General Cortez. If you do manage to escape, will you do as Prince Cuitlahua says and come back?
Certainly. You imagine that I discovered this land only to abandon it? Do you suppose that my men and I have suffered cruel hardships only to be cheated out of our reward? No. We have claimed Mexico in the name of His Catholic Majesty, Charles of Spain. And I shall return and rule it as Governor General.
Thank you, General Cortez. There's still no sign of Montezuma. As you heard, General Cortez and the Aztec commander, Prince Cuitlahua, seem to be in complete disagreement as to what Montezuma will say when he speaks to the prince. From time to time, since this expedition arrived in Mexico City, the emperor has made statements concerning the Spaniards. We've been broadcasting these statements. Quincy Howe in our news headquarters here in Mexico City has been analyzing tape recordings of these broadcasts for a clue to what Montezuma will do today. He's ready now with his analysis. Go ahead, Quincy Howe.
It's safe to say that if today's events had happened 6 months ago, Montezuma would have commanded the Aztecs to lift the siege and allow the Spaniards to leave Mexico. For the emperor at that time regarded General Cortez and his men with fear and superstitious awe. Just listen, for instance, to this tape recording of a broadcast from the Cortez expedition made on November 8th, 8 months ago, the day the Spaniards arrived at the gateway to Mexico City. The little Spanish party, only 500 men and a few horses and cannon, was surrounded by hundreds of thousands of Aztec warriors. Montezuma had only to say the word, and this huge army would have wiped out the Spaniards. Instead, here is what Montezuma did say to General Cortez.
O Lord of ours, descendant of the god Quetzalcoatl, be welcome. You have arrived in your land, Mexico. You have come to sit on your throne. This is indeed what had been told us by the bygone kings and wise men, that you would return to rule these lands.
Montezuma hailed General Cortez as the Messiah of the Aztecs. Cortez and his men entered Mexico City, and the emperor entertained them lavishly in his great palace. The emperor's younger brother, Prince Cuitlahua, and other prominent Aztecs argued that the Spaniards were not gods and should be put to death. Montezuma ignored them. The protests continued, and finally, a month later, Montezuma called his nobles together and addressed them as follows.
Nobles of Mexico, it has come to me that some among you still doubt that the strangers have come to Mexico in the name of Quetzalcoatl. These murmurings against the white men must cease. To put all doubts at rest, I myself, your emperor, am ready to acknowledge their authority over our realm. And I call upon you, my vassals, also to acknowledge their great king beyond the waters. Furthermore, I command you to pay him the tribute that you have hitherto paid me.
Montezuma swore fealty to Charles V of Spain, but then General Cortez invaded the Aztec sanctuaries and smashed the idols. The Aztecs rebelled, and Montezuma was taken hostage. So it must now be clear to Montezuma that the Spaniards are not gods. Having grasped this fact, Montezuma will... Don Hollenbeck, from the top of the Aztec War Gods Temple, reports that Montezuma has come out of the royal palace. Go ahead, Don Hollenbeck.
From our vantage point on top of this Aztec temple 150 feet high, we can see the Emperor Montezuma's litter passing through the courtyard of the palace. As yet, he's blocked from the view of the Aztecs outside the palace by the courtyard wall, but they certainly can hear the music of this royal band of musicians which accompanies the monarch, music produced by a strange assortment of shell horns and drums. The emperor's litter is carried by 8 of the Aztec nobles who accompanied Montezuma into captivity. These nobles now wear rough cotton cloaks over their rich attire because they are in the presence of their emperor. One noble walks in front of the litter carrying the gold wand, which symbolizes the monarch's sovereignty. Another noble carries the royal banner of the House of Montezuma. It's a flag showing an eagle pouncing on an ocelot. The procession has now reached the gateway from the palace to the square. John Daly at the pavilion now has a better view of the emperor's arrival, so over to him. Go ahead, John Daly.
The Aztecs have seen their emperor approaching. Officers are shouting commands, and the hundreds of thousands of soldiers and civilians in and around the square are prostrating themselves on the ground. Only Prince Cuitlahua remains on his feet. As a member of the royal family, he is permitted to do so in the imperial presence. These Aztecs regard their emperor with supreme fear and awe. Montezuma's litter is lavishly decorated with gold and silver and precious stones, and the royal procession now is almost at the pavilion. Let's listen for a moment to the music. Montezuma is descending now from the litter, walks along the carpet to the throne. The multitude still kneels in silent awe. We can see the Spanish soldiers standing by embrasures in the wall, and we can't see their guns, but they must be ready to fire if Montezuma fails to keep his promise.
And now Montezuma has reached the throne. He turns to Prince Cuitlahua. The emperor is speaking.
Cuitlahua, my brother, bid my subjects rise.
Warriors of Mexico, your emperor bids you rise.
Rise!
Like a wave rolling over the great square, the multitude of Aztec soldiers and civilians is rising. Prince Cuitlahua moves toward the emperor, kneels, touches the floor of the pavilion with his right hand, then touches his forehead with the same hand, an Aztec gesture of homage to royalty. Prince Cuitlahua rises, and now he is speaking.
Sire, your subjects rejoice to see you and hear your voice. We await your command.
I thank you.
Prince, my command is that you lift this siege at once and commit General Cortez and the Spaniards to leave Mexico in safety.
By the gods, sire, the invaders have defiled our temples. They have dared to hold you captive. Surely you must now understand that they are enemies of Mexico. Speak the word. Condemn the Spaniards to die.
You have heard my command. Obey.
Are you a woman? Is it because their guns are pointed at you that...
Silence!
I will not be silent. You have no right, sire, to let these men escape. They will return to Mexico. They will overthrow our house. They will make slaves of us and our people.
You dare defy your emperor?
I will not buy your life at the expense of our empire. Your command is to be obeyed. It must be in the direction of the council of priests and nobles. I will consult with them.
I am the ruler of Mexico. Not the council.
True, your majesty. But your command involves the safety of our nation. I cannot take it upon myself. I must consult with the council of priests and nobles.
Prince Cuitlahua kneels rapidly, makes the Aztec gesture of homage, and now he has risen and is walking rapidly back to his party. Montezuma stares at the prince, but now he too has turned, is walking back to his litter. Prince Cuitlahua is talking excitedly with his officers. He and his men know for a fact what they refused to believe before, that their emperor has chosen to betray them in order to save his life. The shock and anger is evident in their faces, and the news has spread like wildfire through the ranks of the soldiers and reached the civilians and the crowds beyond. Montezuma has entered his litter. The carriers lift it to their shoulders and begin to carry the emperor back to the palace. Cuitlahua and his party are moving away across the square toward the temple of the Aztec god of war. The council will probably meet there to reach a decision on the emperor's command. The council is second in authority only to the emperor. Will the council obey Montezuma in this national crisis? For an opinion on that from a member of the emperor's own family, we take you inside the royal palace. Ken Roberts reports.
Here in one of the royal apartments is the Emperor Montezuma's daughter, Princess Tenocha. Only a few months ago, the princess embraced Christianity and is married to one of General Cortez's Spanish officers. The princess assures us that the council will obey her father. Princess Tenocha, will you tell us, please, why you think the priests and nobles will follow the emperor's orders?
The council must obey. It is unthinkable for lesser men to counter the will of their emperor.
But isn't it true, Your Highness, that the priests outnumber the nobles on the council, and don't you think they'll vote against letting the Spaniards go because they hate them for attempting to convert the Aztecs to Christianity?
Yes, the priests hate the Spaniards, but they will vote to obey my father. Montezuma is not only the emperor of Mexico. He is also the high priest of the Aztec faith.
Well, if the priests do yield and allow the Spaniards to escape, would you leave Mexico with them?
My place is with my husband, wherever he goes.
If that happens, Your Highness, do you think you'll ever return to Mexico?
We will return. General Cortez has sworn not to rest until Mexico becomes a Christian nation. The general has sworn to tear down the idol of Huitzilopochtli and erect the true cross of Jesus Christ in its place.
Well,
as an Aztec princess, how do you feel about the overthrow of the state religion?
When my father became emperor, 100,000 slaves were put to death on the sacrificial block to celebrate the coronation. Each day in each temple, in every city of Mexico, 4 slaves are put to death as part of the normal daily rites of worship. We Aztecs eat the flesh of human beings. The meat of slaves is served up at the banquet table. I myself, because I lived in ignorance and sin, have eaten human flesh. And may the Lord forgive me. If the house of my father must be overthrown to deliver my people from hideous darkness, I say let it be overthrown. Let the royal house of Mexico perish.
Thank you, Princess Tenocha. Don Hollenbeck at the Temple of the Aztec War God reports the Council of Priests and Nobles has finished its deliberations. Prince Cuitlahua is on his way back to the pavilion outside the palace. There will be some time, though, before he arrives there. Meanwhile, there are other Aztecs in the palace who do not agree with the views just expressed by the Emperor's daughter. One of them is imprisoned below us in the palace dungeons. Doug Edwards is with him. Go ahead, Doug Edwards.
Here in one of the small cells of the royal dungeon, Prince Cacama of Tezcuco is shackled to the wall with a length of heavy chain. A guard is pacing back and forth. Prince Cacama was imprisoned here by Montezuma 5 months ago at the request of General Cortez. The general claimed that the prince was inciting the Aztecs against the Spaniards. Prince Cacama, do you think the Council of Priests and Nobles will obey the Emperor Montezuma's command and permit the Spaniards to leave Mexico?
You see these chains? They are white man's chains, brought here by Cortez to shackle Aztecs. Today I wear the chains, but tomorrow the Spaniards shall wear them. They shall rot here until their hearts are torn out of their breasts and presented to our God.
Then you think the council will refuse to obey Montezuma?
Montezuma has the soul of a slave. The heart of a traitor. He has tried to sell our people into slavery to save his life. But the lords of Mexico will not submit and let a weakling king betray our empire. The council of priests and nobles elected Montezuma emperor. What was done can be undone.
You think the council will depose Montezuma?
They will tear his crown from his head. They will smear his body with filth as a sign of his treason and give him the death of a traitor. They will order the army to attack the palace and overwhelm the Spanish dogs. They will sacrifice them to the gods to atone for the shame, the dishonor that Montezuma has brought on Mexico.
Thank you, Prince Cacama. John Daly, in the pavilion outside the palace, reports that the Emperor Montezuma is returning to hear the decision of the Council of Priests and Nobles. So back to the pavilion and John Daly.
The Emperor Montezuma's litter is approaching the pavilion, and once again the royal standard bearer walks ahead, and then come the musicians and the procession of courtiers attached to the Emperor's throne. This time the vast crowd of Aztecs in the square do not kneel at the approach of their emperor. They're silent, but their faces are sullen and resentful. Prince Cuitlahua and his officers are waiting near the pavilion, and they aren't kneeling either. It's very significant that this great mass of soldiers and civilians here should stand as the emperor enters into the front of the pavilion, but we don't know yet exactly what it means. And even more ominous is the line of spearmen displaying the heads of Spanish soldiers on the tips of their spears. It has been replaced by a line of archers. Now Montezuma's litter has halted. The emperor descends from the litter, walks slowly along the carpet to the throne. He does not look at Prince Cuitlahua as he passes him. This is the moment, if the council's decision is to obey Montezuma, his position on the Aztec throne will be secure. But on the other hand, if Prince Cacama's prediction is borne out here, Montezuma
Wait!
Will...
Wait, Montezuma! Do not seat yourself on the throne!
Prince Cuitlahua has stopped Montezuma from ascending the throne. The emperor has stopped and turned toward the prince. There's a look of
Montezuma,
fear on his face. Prince Cuitlahua again.
The council of priests and nobles have found you unworthy because of your cowardice and treason to remain upon the throne of Mexico. The council has stripped you of the crown and scepter. You are deposed.
The council has not the power to depose me.
The priests and nobles of Mexico have condemned you to die.
They cannot.
Warrior
they cannot
of
the
Mexico, the man who stands before you is no longer your emperor. He's been condemned to death as a traitor. Kill him.
I am your emperor. Warriors, I command you.
Montezuma has been struck in the breast by an arrow. An arrow from an Aztec bow. He's been hit by another arrow and still another. The company of archers in front of the pavilion are piercing him again and again. Montezuma falls to the ground as the Aztec warriors shout, "Coward! Traitor! Die!" And now on the courtyard wall, the Spanish trumpeters are sounding the alarm. The truce has been broken. Montezuma's desperate effort to save his own life and the lives of Cortez and his men have failed. The man who for 18 years ruled this Aztec empire, an absolute monarch, wealthy and powerful beyond the wildest dreams of Europeans, now lies dead or dying here before the wall of his own palace, struck down by his own people. They've judged him a coward and a traitor, and they've given him a traitor's death. General Cortez's gamble to save himself.
June 30th, 1520, Mexico City. Montezuma betrays the Aztecs and dies at the hands of his own people.
Footnote. After the death of Montezuma, General Cortez and his men fought their way out of Mexico. They returned later, however, with hundreds of thousands of Indian allies and destroyed the empire of the Aztecs. You have been listening to The Death of Montezuma, another broadcast in the series You Are There, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne.
You Are There, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 1st of May 1949 on CBS, the program written and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne, who at one time was a producer for WOR and a producer, writer, and director for CBS Radio based out of New York. With his You Are There series, it's no surprise that he was also a teacher at the Annenberg School for Communication and the University of Pennsylvania. You are listening to an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. And now time for the story of Commodore David Porter, a naval hero, for a time anyway, during the early 1800s, on the Cavalcade of America in a play called Man of Action from April 17, 1951 on NBC.
DuPont Company of Wilmington, Delaware, makers of better things for better living through chemistry, presents the Cavalcade of America. Tonight's star, Dane Clark.
The year is 1843. David Porter, the United States Minister to Turkey, sits quietly in his garden in Constantinople. Bring me the flag, Abdul. Let me look at it.
I was about to raise it, Your Excellency.
No, let me have it. Getting old and worn, Abdul.
Ah, but it's still... Yes, Your Excellency. A great flag. Your flag.
Yes, it's mine. I've served it. Oh, not like now, sitting here landlocked in a Turkish garden. But at sea. At sea in a ship under full sail with all the guns manned, bearing down on the enemy.
Well, Your Excellency, do not excite yourself. The doctor says you must be careful.
Careful. I've never been careful. I don't intend to start now. Risks, chances. That's a man's life. Risk, chances for this flag, Abdul. Do you know I was 16 and already an officer in the Navy when I took my first great risk?
Oh?
I was on a merchant ship off Santo Domingo when a British frigate boarded me and tried to force me into British service.
What is your name, lad?
My own affair.
Do they teach no manners in America? How old are you?
I'm old enough to know that you had no right to take me from my ship. You have no right.
Right? You Americans speak of nothing but right. Put him in irons and behold. Perhaps then we shall hear less of these rights.
Are you awake?
I'm awake, all right. Have you ever tried to sleep in these habits?
Quiet.
You've come to torment me. You can save your breath.
Hold your breath, boy. Talk civil, and I'll take my hand from your mouth. There. Now, listen. I have the key to these irons, and I've come to help you off this ship.
But you're a British.
Aye, that I am. But you see, I ain't the captain. And my mates and I, well, we like the bold way you stood up to him. We like the cocky courier jib making. There. You're free. Now listen. There's a Danish brig moored 50 yards off a starboard bow. You can swim?
I can do
well. Good. Keep underwater as long as you can, and when I give the word, one of us will slip aside the ash grating above. Run like the wind, lad, and then dive. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Good. Wait. You know this is risky. You're willing to take a chance?
Well, why not?
You might get killed by one of the guard.
I'll take my chance.
Good boy. On deck there. Get a move on with the ash. Good luck, lady. Up you go.
Who's that? Oh, stop! Ah! Stop!
Chances, yes, Abdul, I started early. It was not the careful ones who put the stars in his flag or kept the flag aloft. And there weren't very many stars in the flag when I first managed to keep her aloft against odds. I was 20 and second in command of the schooner Experiment under Captain Maley. It was off Haiti, and we were attacked by the pirate Rigo with 12 pirate barges with swivel guns in their bows. It looked hopeless to Captain Maley.
Lieutenant Porter.
Aye, aye, Captain.
You will strike the colors.
Without firing a shot?
They have us outnumbered 10-1. You will strike the colors.
And yield an American ship of war to that filthy mob of pirates?
Porter.
Wake Downs, I say we fight. Are you with me?
Yes, we're with you.
Lieutenant Porter, I'll have you put in chains. I am in command of this ship.
All hands to quarters. Man the guns. Blow those grape and canisters.
All hands to quarters!
You'll be broken for this. I'll bring charges. You're a hot-headed boy, and I'll bring you to trial.
If we win, Captain, the credit will be yours and the punishment mine. But if we lose, well, dead men tell no tales.
Battle station's fully manned, sir.
Guns are ready, Lieutenant.
You may order a broadside.
Right. Come in!
After 7 hours of desperate fighting, we won the day. And the credit went to Captain Maley. But the risk for the cause, that is my nature. I remember when I was aboard the Philadelphia when she went aground off Tripoli. And even as brave a man as Captain Bainbridge thought that we should remain in the Bashaw's prison and not attempt an escape. But again, I wanted to take the risk.
What you're proposing, Porter, is extremely dangerous.
Captain Bainbridge, I will be frank. I'm not just proposing a plan for escape. It's all set up. We await only your word.
I don't understand.
We have been digging a tunnel to the dungeon below where the crew is quartered. And 2 days ago, we broke through.
But it's dangerous, Porter. It's extremely dangerous. If we are discovered, it means torture. Perhaps death.
I shall take full responsibility.
Yes, you take a good deal, Mr. Porter, but you don't suppose I'd allow my junior officer to take responsibility for an act such as this?
We don't have to be discovered until it's too late for them to do anything about it. I have been in communication with the crew. We've exchanged letters.
What? How?
Well, among the books the Danish consul brought us in prison, there was one telling us how to make a secret ink. A vanishing ink that reappears when the paper is washed in water.
And you'll risk your neck on a thing like this, a magician's trick?
Well, it's better than sitting here the rest of our lives. And we can alert the crew, and when the time comes, we can...
For God.
Captain Bainbridge?
Yes?
Which of your officers is Lieutenant Porter?
I am Lieutenant Porter.
You will come with me.
Wait. I'm in command here. I'm responsible for whatever happens to my officer.
Where are you taking me?
To the audience chamber of the Bashaw.
Porter, be careful. Keep your head. You have no idea. Torture.
Come along. The Bashaw is impatient.
Lieutenant Porter, you have been communicating with the members of your crew, have you not? You do not answer. Well, Lieutenant, if you do not use your tongue, the guard there, with a single stroke of his knife, can arrange that you shall never use your tongue again. You do not tremble. Perhaps you are ignorant of our customs.
I have heard of your tortures.
Oh, so he speaks. And with such arrogance. You may wonder how we know that you have been communicating with your crew. The art of making secret inks is old in the countries of Islam. He still has nothing to say. Guard, the whip.
The Bashaw thinks that only his corsairs have courage and he has much to learn.
And you are prepared to teach me then? Huh? To furnish us with an example of, shall we say, Christian fortitude?
I am. And remember this. I am nothing. But the uniform I wear is the uniform of the Navy of the United States of America, and each blow you strike on my back will call up a broadside on your marketplace. Commander Preble's fleet rides at Malta, and tomorrow, the next day, or next week, he'll bring your palace down around your dirty ears. Preble's the greatest sea fighter in the world today, and when he...
Wait, I say, put your whip away. It is plain, Lieutenant Porter, that you are a man of spirit, and such we admire. You will return to your countrymen in the prison, but do not think hereafter that we are so innocent that we do not know what is going on in our prison.
It wasn't all hardtack, stalled horse, and beat to quarters. After Commodore Preble made good my threat, I returned to America. And a somewhat different kind of risk. I met her in Washington at a party. Her name was Evelina Anderson, and she was very pretty. Very pert.
They told me you were of the dashing sort, Commander, but I declare you've quite outdone all the heroes of my acquaintance.
You know many heroes, girl?
Oh, yes. All of Commodore Preble's pirate chases are visited here. Even the great Stephen Decatur. But none of them has asked for my hand in marriage within an hour of first acquaintance.
Well, my mind is made up, girl. We're to be married.
Oh, do stop calling me girl. I'm not under your command.
Evelina, Well, perhaps I've been too hasty. I've been little ashore these past years. I've been a deep water sailor since I was 12. I don't know the right words. I've fallen in love with you, girl.
Perhaps you could manage to sound a little less explosive. Boy.
Evelina?
Hmm?
Darling, I love you with all my heart. I knew it the moment I saw you.
Well, that's better.
Then you will? You will marry me?
Well, I do like you, David. And when I first saw you, well, something happened. But I'm not a pirate schooner to be taken by storm after one broadside.
Sorry,
And well, in any event, you'd need to ask my father's permission.
Yes, I suppose I must. Goodbye, Evelina.
Where are you going?
To ask your father's hand in marriage.
But David, I haven't said you might. David!
You are the Honorable William Anderson?
I am.
I am David Porter, Commander of the United States Navy. I have the honor, sir, to request the hand of your daughter in marriage.
Well, of all the unmitigated gall. Young man?
Yes, sir?
Listen to me. No penniless sailor can ever hope to marry my daughter. You have no future, young man. And I forbid you to marry her.
Is that all, sir?
Yes, that's all.
Thank you. But I must warn you, sir, the breaching of obstacles is the joy of my life. Good day, sir. I think I need hardly add that Evelina and I were married shortly after with the blessings of Mr. Anderson. Congress crippled the Navy, but I was able to keep my hand in fighting pirates in the Gulf and their lawyer friends ashore in New Orleans. And there in New Orleans, Evelina and I adopted a son whose name, like mine, was David, and who, like me, loved the Navy.
Mother?
Yes, David.
Will there be war?
Yes, perhaps we'll know today when the commander returns.
Will they give him a ship? Will they make him captain?
If they don't, he's
quite capable of marching on Washington and breaking down the president's very door. Oh, I think I hear him coming.
Evelina! Glorious news, Gloria.
What's happened?
The country has decided to cringe and crawl no more. My commission as captain is in the hands of the secretary, and I'm to command the Essex. 32 guns, think of it, I'm to have the Essex.
And what am I to have? Years of loneliness, years of widowhood, Dad.
Oh, my dear Evelina, you understand. You've always understood me. Be happy with me.
I shall try.
You'll have our children, Evelina. That is all except Davy here.
And why not David?
His commission as midshipman in the Essex will arrive at the same time as my own official promotion.
What? Davy? Little Davy? Well, he's only 11 years old.
Well, it's high time he put to sea. What do you say, lad? Isn't it high time young David Farragut put to sea?
Aye, aye, sir.
Good for you, Midshipman Farragut. And so the outbreak of the war with England in 1812 brought me in command of the Essex. I was ordered to join my old friend, Captain Bainbridge, commanding the USS Constitution somewhere in the South Atlantic. Exact whereabouts unknown. Our mission, to destroy England's commerce. But I couldn't locate Bainbridge, so I disguised the Essex as a British man of war and put in at a Portuguese island in search of information.
Captain Porter, sir?
Yes, Midshipman Davy Farragut. What is it?
Must I always call you captain when we're on board ship, sir?
Always, Davy. As far as I'm concerned, you're just another midshipman. Midshipman David Farragut.
Is the Captain Bainbridge we're trying to find, is he the same one you were with in prison in Tripoli, Father? Sir?
Yes, boy.
The time you used the vanishing ink?
Yeah. Oh, that must be Lieutenant Downs with news at Bainbridge. Come in.
Captain Porter, sir. Hmm? I called upon the governor as ordered. He's completely deceived. He believes we're an English ship.
And what news of Bainbridge?
None of Bainbridge, Captain, but two British frigates have visited here in the past week, the Acasta and the Morgiana.
There are no such ships in the English Navy?
Well, sir, the Acasta's captain left a letter addressed to Captain Sir James Yeo in England. I told the authorities we'd deliver it.
Let's see it.
Sir?
See. My dear friend Yeo, probably you may stop here or we may meet at San Salvador. I should be happy to converse on our old affairs of captivity. Recollect our secret in those times. Your friend of H.M. McCaffrey, Captain James Kerr.
No, it's not much use to us, is it, sir?
Old affairs of captivity. Recollect our secret in those times.
Sir?
Come over here, will you? This bowl of water.
I don't understand, sir. Do you know this, Captain Kerr?
Now, I place this letter in the bowl of water. Now, watch. Just watch the back of it.
Mm-hmm.
There, you see? You see?
There's writing.
Well, read it, Midshipman Farragut.
My dear Porter, go off Cape Frio to the northward of Rio de Janeiro and keep a lookout for me. Your former fellow prisoner, William Bainbridge.
Make sail, Lieutenant. We're bound for Rio. But Bainbridge and the Constitution were not to be found, so we searched for months. Finally, with our supplies running low, our situation grew desperate. And in December, I called an officer's council.
All the officers are here now, sir.
Good. Gentlemen, our supplies are running low, and the British have blockaded every port we could reach. Now, our choice lies between starvation and capture. I take it that you have all sailed with me long enough to know that I shall accept neither of these choices. I take it also that you came to see the fight, and to do our enemy as much damage as may be.
Yes, sir.
Now, if we remain in the South Pacific, we must starve or we must surrender. If we head north, we face capture or blockade in a home port. Therefore, gentlemen, I propose to take this ship around the Horn and into the Pacific.
Captain, we'll never make it, sir.
What?
This is no whaling ship, sir. We're not built to take these Cape Horn gales. We can't make it, sir.
We can and we will. And we did. And when we reached the Pacific, we found, as I had expected, that the British had left their Pacific commerce without protection. And we fell upon them, taking prize after prize. And after a year of tremendous success, however, we awoke one morning in a neutral Chilean port and found that two British frigates were patrolling the harbor entrance. I arranged a meeting with Captain Hillier of the HMS Phoebe.
Delighted to see you, Captain Porter. I have come halfway around the world to meet you, sir. All the way from Calcutta.
Captain Hillier, do you propose to respect the neutrality of this port?
Oh, come now, Porter. Must we move so rapidly to business? I had wished to congratulate you upon your recent exploits over a bottle of wine.
Thank you. But I must know...
Why, man, your name is ringing through the wardrooms of all the world's navies and through half the counting houses in England. You said you well-nigh ruined Lloyd's of London.
Still, Captain, I must press for an answer. Do you intend to respect Hillier neutrality?
Since you have paid so much respect to it, I am bound to do likewise.
Good. And I will not need to keep my crew at quarters day and night. On the other hand, sir, it would give me the greatest pleasure to settle all differences between us.
Is this a challenge, Captain?
Well, since mine is a smaller ship, I should be condemned by Navy Department if I offered a challenge. But a challenge from you would be most welcome.
I have two ships, Captain Porter. I fear the Lords of the Admiralty would expect me to use both of them.
Captain, I'd be outgunned and outranged by the Phoebe alone. Let the Cherub stay at anchor. Take out the Phoebe and I will follow. And I can promise you a most interesting morning.
And I can promise you, Captain Porter, that I would be forced to use both my ships. Therefore, I doubt if you will leave the port of Valparaiso. May I offer you more of this excellent wine?
Well, there you have it, Midshipman Farragut. Two ships against one. Short-range guns against long 12. Safety in port. Possible death and destruction beyond the harbor. Well, there's a tactical problem for you, boy.
What would Commodore Preble have done, sir?
That's what I've been asking myself, lad, these past three sleepless nights.
There's a gear blowing up, sir.
Yes, I see.
In an hour, there'll be heavy weather beyond the harbor bar. We might just slip by, sir.
I've taken notice of the weather, lad. It's a habit we have.
Sorry, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry myself. My nerves are on edge, son. Oh. On deck with you. Tell Lieutenant Cowell I wish to see him at once. By heaven, I won't stand it. We're getting out of here, whatever the odds.
Captain, why not? The British are bearing down on us fast.
Well, bend on more sails.
But this wind may blow away our main topmast. What's that? Captain! Captain, there it goes! There goes the main topmast! Captain, we can't bring our guns to bear on them. The wind keeps our stern towards the British.
Bring a line from the stern to the anchor cable. Fire a whopper around so we can bring a broadside to bear.
We can't make it, Captain. We can't bring her around. We can only fire with a three stern gun.
What canvas can we set, Lieutenant?
Only the flying jib, Captain.
Then cut the anchor cable and set the ship. If we can move at all, we'll try to board them.
What? Board them?
By heaven, we'll crawl toward them on our hands and knees.
Stand by the board!
Captain, Captain, we can never get in close enough to board, sir.
I know.
We have no guns left that can fire, sir.
It was a risk, Lieutenant. We had to take it. We had to take the chance.
Captain Porter! Captain Porter!
It's Hillier on the Phoebe, Captain.
Captain Porter, will you strike your colors?
Oh, no.
Will you surrender, Captain Porter?
Oh, sir, his next broadside will blow us out of the water.
Strike the colors, Lieutenant. Strike the colors. Captain Hillier, I presume I am your prisoner.
Captain Porter, if it is any satisfaction, I did what I had to do, but with a heavy heart. And I must say never, in all the annals of the sea, has a ship fought against greater odds with greater courage or greater skill.
Excellency.
Hmm? Yes. I've gone and told you that entire story again, haven't I?
May I take the flag now? It is sunrise. It's time to raise it.
Yes, Abdul. Take it. Raise it. Each morning is a new morning, and old defeats should be forgotten. There will be fresh victories on the morrow. Not for me or for the rest of Preble's boys, but for other young men of faith and courage and daring.
To the fiery young men known as Preble's boys, who served under Commodore Edward Preble against Tripoli and founded the fighting tradition of the American Navy, and to Porter's sons, Admiral David Dixon Porter and Admiral David Farragut, and to the officers and men who uphold that tradition today, this broadcast is respectfully dedicated. To Bane Clark and the Cavalcade Players for tonight's story.
The Cavalcade of America on Tuned to Yesterday from the 17th of April, 1951 on NBC. And that wraps up this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVonier. Thanks for listening.